Okay, it's now 8 o'clock, time for this morning's Sunday sermon. Sunday morning. And when I thought like that a minute ago, I remembered that before we had our own retreat center here, we used to hire a retreat center in North Perth. It was part of they call Redemptorist Monastery, Catholic place. And I remember what happened one morning. I was giving the talk at 8 o'clock for the retreatants and really getting into it, a nice Buddhist talk. And then the priest from the church next door rushed in. He said, "Stop, stop." I said, "Well, why? You know, we hired this place." He said, no, "Your Wi-Fi is actually going to our speakers. They're not hearing me, they're hearing you." not on purpose. Remember that the Lord works in mysterious ways or something. He wasn't impressed with us. But anyway, it was good fun. So we had to stop for a while and readjust the Wi-Fi. It's much better when we have our own system so we don't interfere with other people's sermons. But anyway, of course, many of you know me by now, that sort of laughter, that joy is an important way of engaging in this world. And when you learn how to laugh easily, it does mean that, you know, you have more attention to the world. You're more involved in what's going on. You've got more energy. You are more mindful. And that mindfulness grows and grows and grows. You do actually laugh easier. And you have a bit more fun in what you're doing. And even with something like meditation, the meditation gets more enjoyable. And of course, I've mentioned that so often, that once the meditation gets enjoyable, you start meditating, you really look forward to, "Oh, this feels really good." It's easy to be mindful and sit a long period of time. And you're not so interested in other things in the world, because the joy of meditation is just too good. And that's one of the reasons why when you come on retreat, hopefully, first of all, you need to restrain the senses by not looking around so much or not checking your email so much and stuff like that. And that the entertainment you miss by not watching those programs and stuff, I supply. And just replacing that so it's interesting. You look forward to coming to these talks and Q&As and stuff, and you enjoy meditating. And little by little, as you enjoy it more and more, it's a natural process. The mind becomes more peaceful, and mindfulness becomes more easy, and you become more alert, not just to how your body is, but now what's happening in the world, not the big world outside, but what's happening in nature. And just as I was preparing to talk, I was totally pleasantly distracted by the sound of the birds just outside. It's gorgeous, listening to the birds chirping away. Because how often do you have the opportunity to do that when you are going to work in the car or something? This nature here is safe. And it's gorgeous. I don't know if any of you are afraid of snakes, but we have a wonderful snake here. Has he been around yet, the dugite? It's probably one of the most dangerous snakes in the world, but this one is a Buddhist. So he's non-harming. And every now and again you see him here, especially, I think it's a bit too cold yet for them to come out. But it's a gorgeous little animal. And he just... Don't go too close to it and scare it, but you can look at it from a distance and it doesn't harm at all. It's just wonderful to appreciate the animals, which can be dangerous. They can just come and soak up the sun here, enjoy the peace and quiet here, and not be harmful to you at all. It just shows you just how a bit of kindness and peace and everything in the world seems to get into balance. But anyway, that sort of inspires you. And that allows the mindfulness to grow. Don't push and make mindfulness happen quickly. And don't say, "Well, I've only done 6 hours meditation today and there's 24 hours in a day. Oh, my goodness. I've got to pick it up to 7, or 8, or 9, or 10, or 12, or 5. Never think like that. Don't try and improve your personal best. Every moment, every minute is just the only place where you live on this retreat. And if ever you wonder what the time is, I have to find out what the time is now because we're live streaming this over to Singapore. But if you ever really want to find out what the real time is, go in that hall over there, the most accurate clocks in the wall in the world. On that big wall there. In other words, it's just now. And it's the nowth day of the nowth month of 2020 now. At 9 minutes past now o'clock. And when you make a bit of fun and games like that, it brings out the message very clearly. In our present moment, that's where we can find some mindfulness and peace. Why on earth not? And living in the present moment is not something which was invented by Eckhart Tolle. That's in the Bhattacharya Sutta, there are three of them, all talking about living in the present moment, abandoning the past, not rushing off into the future, and learning to live in the present moment, just now. What a beautiful thing that is. So you can be totally free. All the burdens you have in life, all the possessions you have, they weigh you down. And especially the major possessions are your past, your history. And because we carry that around really heavily, that sometimes we feel that we are imprisoned by our past. And that's why people have to go and see therapists, psychologists. And where did the psychologists and therapists go when they feel imprisoned? They come here to Jhanakul. And it's something which is strange. But I've known this, Ajahn Chah taught this, it's true, that it isn't that hard to let go of your past, even if it's been traumatic, if you know how to do it. And how to do it is be kind to it. The mindfulness and kindness are really important, not the mindfulness and criticism. Because a criticism, I don't like this, or blaming, why did they do that to me? Or guilty, no, I must have encouraged it somewhere. All those very unhealthy and inaccurate and unfair responses to the past. Why do we do that? Why is it so easy to remember the faults of the past? And very rarely remember the wonderful times you've had in the past, which are also there. We're human beings who often just focuses on faults and mistakes, overly. People do make mistakes. I make mistakes. That's one another mistake, by saying I make mistakes. I might be messing around. But when we learn how to understand that whatever happens in life, we call those learning experiences. This is how, you know, we can take that. We can't change the past, but we can take from it, understand more, so we become better and better. There's this old Buddhist story about the five types of horses. And at the end of this, I'm going to ask you, which horse do you identify with? The first horse, when the rider gets on the horse's back and the rider tells the horse to go somewhere, straight away the horse goes where the rider asks it. It's a well-trained horse, a very smart horse. The second horse, when you get on its back, say, go over there, it just won't go. So the owner has to get the whip out. And just the shadow of the whip falls on the horse's back. And the horse, oh, I better go and follow the orders. And so the horse does that, goes where it needs to go. The third horse is more stupid. When the owner gets on his back and tells it to go over there, and the horse doesn't want to go. Gets out the whip, the stick, and the stick shadow falls on the horse, the horse still doesn't want to go. So you have to just tap it lightly, don't hurt it, just tap it, and oh, the horse, yeah, I better go. That's the third type of horse. The fourth type of horse is even more stupid, it doesn't want to go, it's just really independent, stubborn. So the owner has to whack it, wow! But only once, and it lives, well, better not do that again. And then off the horse goes. And the last type of horse, horse number fifth, whack, 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 and still doesn't know why his life is so much suffering. Now, of all those five horses, which one do you associate with? Horse number five? Why? Sometimes when life hurts, we think, oh, why did that happen? But anyway, once we learn, we can let everything go. That's what the past is for, learning from. And once we graduate, once you graduate from school, do you have to go back again? Mm-hmm. Once you go to university and get your degrees, do you have to go back again? Once you finish your first 9-day retreat, do you have to come back here again? Yes, how many times? Why? But it's also the case that once we understand what the purpose of the past is, we can let it go pretty easily. Why burden yourself with things? It's like putting rucksacks, big backpacks full of rocks on your back. They don't really call it a rucksack, it's a rock sack. And it's so heavy. And you're trudging up this very muddy mountain. It's very high. It's really hard work. You don't know what you're going up there for until someone says to you, just take off the backpack. I can't. Just take it back. Take it off. Oh, why not? Why do you have to be a prisoner of your past? Whatever happened. You can take it off and just be in this moment. Right here in this retreat center. Doesn't matter what's happened to you in the past. Doesn't matter who you are. Doesn't matter how many jhanas you've had. Doesn't matter just if you've been in prison. Doesn't matter. This is a story which I love telling. Oh, it happens sometimes when we're organizing retreats that it's hard to get, you know, the volunteers, you know, to do things like the cleaning and the cooking and the organizing. On this one occasion, we just couldn't get the cook. And we said, oh, this is really hard. And we've got the retreat already organized. And all the cooks which I knew, they were all busy. So I managed to get this one guy as a cook. And he was fantastic. You know, just the quality of his food and just how quickly he did it was amazing. And everybody loved him. You see him cooking there in the morning. And he made these pizzas. And the whole thing all by himself, you know, even the base, and cut up everything and did all the work, just single-handedly. It was amazing to watch. He didn't just do pizzas, he did all sorts of really nice food. And, you know, people really loved him and just thought he was a great fellow that he was offering his services. He offered the services for free. And it's only the end of the retreat, once it was the last talk, which, you know, said we, you know, should thank everybody out of gratitude, especially the cook, which was Carl, his name was. And he said, no, I got permission for him to come and cook here because he's an inmate at Carnate Prison Farm. He was a prisoner, a criminal. Sexual offences. And people said, what? And I allowed. They allowed, everybody allowed. You know, he did that because he was drugged up to his eyeballs. He wasn't in his right sense of mind. And I knew him because other monks knew him because he'd been up to Carnate Prison Farm and other places many times. And the amazing thing was that once actually they saw him and how he behaved, and once, you know, they realized that how easy it is to judge somebody, he did do bad things in the past. That was in the past. And I was totally clear that, you know, he would be no danger at all, and it give him a lot of confidence, and also be a teaching, a really good teaching for everybody. You can't just judge a person because of their past. Otherwise, I took my lead from a certain teacher some years ago who ordained a serial killer called Angulimala, and the teacher was the Buddha. The Buddha could see something inside that serial killer, even though other people were just terrified of him, which, you know, you could bring into monastic life, and he became a fully enlightened arahat. Amazing. And so because of that, the past, these are just examples. Someone who was, oh, what was the other one, which is one of my favorite nuns, bhikkhunis. I only figured this out when I started learning Pali and reading some of the stories of enlightened monks and nuns. And then when I started reading about the enlightened nuns in the time of the Buddha, this is not an innovation, this is going back to how the Buddha taught, having fully ordained bhikkhunis. And they had all these bhikkhunis, they were meditating, and they weren't getting anywhere. And they'd been bhikkhunis for 6 or 7 years, not for just a 9-day retreat. And they weren't getting anywhere until this amazing teacher came and taught them how to meditate properly, and they became enlightened, fully enlightened within days. And that teacher, you know, I looked, well, who is this person? And her name was Patachara. And her past, if you don't know this, that, you know, she fell in love, she was from a good family, she fell in love with a poor guy, and so, you know, they ran away to get married, and so they ran away from their family in one town, went to another town, and then when she got pregnant and was about to have a kid, and it happens sometimes that, you know, if your mother doesn't like you, you marry. Once you have a kid, then sometimes all is forgiven. You know, you're giving your grandparents a grandchild to play with. And anyway, that so she was about to give birth, and then she decided to go and visit her parents. But on the way, she gave birth, and so she returned and said, "I'll try and do better next time." And when she was pregnant with her second child, they left a little bit earlier to see their parents. But again, she gave birth on the way, so she had two children, one newly born, and her husband was trying desperately to look after her, to get some camping on the way, maybe one day away from their parents' home, and was collecting some wood to build a fire to keep her warm. And there was a snake in the wood, and the snake bit the husband, and he died. So this Patachara was her husband. Her husband was dead. She had two small kids, and so she thought, "I'd better get to see my parents." And because there was an unseasonal rain, the river which they had to cross was flooded. And normally the husband would be able to help, but he just died. And so the only thing she could do, she left her elder child, 2 or 3 years of old age, on the bank of the river and took the baby across in her arms. And as she took the baby across, she deposited it on the side, and then she was wading back to across the stream to collect her older son, again only 2 or 3 years of age. And as she was crossing in the middle of the stream, an eagle saw the young baby left alone and swooped down and tried to pick it up. And the mother just was waving her arms all over and stopped trying to scare the eagle away. It didn't stop the eagle picking up her child and taking it away. But though waving her arms, the elder son thought that was a signal to try and cross. So the elder son crossed as well and got carried away with the current. So there in the middle of the stream, she saw her two children died. And then she was pretty distraught. And she was trying to get back to her mother and father, at least some place where she could get some solace. And then when she got close to the village, she asked, you know, "Where are they?" And they said, "In that same storm which flooded the river, that a tree fell on their mother and father's house and they died. So she lost in the same day her parents, her children, and her husband. And she couldn't take that. She went crazy. And she was wandering around, not knowing where she was going, what she was doing. And all her clothes fell off. And so she came in to the Jeta Grove Monastery, totally naked. She was a young woman. And the Buddha was giving a sermon. And when she came in, a lot of people tried to get out. You can't come in here dressed like that. If a naked mid-20-year-old came into this room right now, Lehan, what would you do? You don't need to answer. Then people said, get out, get out. And the Buddha said, no, let her come in. And one of the monks had a spare robe and just gave it to her to cover herself up. And the Buddha had such kindness that she settled down. She became a bhikkhuni. And not just any old bhikkhuni. She became this incredible sort of teacher, Patachara, bhikkhuni, arahat. And because of what she'd been through, you think you need a psychologist for years to get through that. Not her. She made use of that and gave her such power, such strength, that she could really teach. So she became one of the great inspirations in Buddhism. So it doesn't matter. Well, it does matter, but you don't need to feel that you are obstructed or lessened or diminished by some of the stuff which may have happened to you. Learn from it. Grow from it. Be strong from it. It's incredible what you can do. So that's one of the reasons why we don't really worry too much about the past. We learn from it, grow from it, and strengthen by it. And that's the sort of place where I get all those stories from. The two bad, not the two bad bits, the stepping in the dog poo. You dig it in the garden. Really stinky, smelly dog poo makes such delicious mangoes. Why not? So little by little, the past is let go of. We're not burdened by it. So we can enjoy the present moment. This is like a retreat. A retreat from what? It's a retreat from the past. A retreat from the future. There's something else which I've noticed all these years I've been a monk, is that when you don't worry about the future, you can spend more time in the present. And you find the future is just works out pretty good. And so often, it's so easy to worry about, are there going to be enough people coming on the retreat? Are there going to be too many people coming on the retreat? How are we going to organize this with, you know, the wonderful people over in Singapore and elsewhere in the world? What's going to happen if this happens or that happens or there's a power outage or blah, 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 blah. There's something which I, again, have noticed. You'd always find a reason, a means to cope, whatever happens. The only thing to be afraid of is fear itself, where we look into the future and we think we can't handle this. All the time it happens. For example, I remember this one time, I was on a time when you could travel, I was supposed to be giving a series of talks in Indonesia. And, you know, in Indonesia, it's, you know, people think that's a Muslim country. It's not a Muslim country. Countries aren't Buddhist. Countries aren't Islamic. People are. That's one of the reasons why, you know, you don't talk to countries, you talk to people. So, no, I got quite a good reputation in Indonesia, and because of that, many people come to the talks, and there's so many different places you have to go to. It's a huge country. So, I was going to give a big talk over in, what was it? I think it was Jogja. Anyway, that when I got to the airport, the flight was not delayed, it was cancelled. The Garuda flight going to Yogyakarta was cancelled till the next day. And I saw all these people, when they went and saw them, they're cancelled. They went to the airport counter and they banged their fists. You can't do this to me. I've got an important meeting. I've got to get there. Get another plane. How can you just manufacture a plane in Perth Airport? You know, the last moment. It's cancelled. I felt very sorry for those people on the desk who had to feel these comments from crazy people. Just because, you know, it didn't happen, you couldn't get on the plane. No need to sort of distress those poor workers there. And anyway, I found out why it had been cancelled. I managed to get borrow a phone and call up the hosts and say, look, I'm sorry, I can't get there today. We'll get there tomorrow. And I said, I found out the reason why the plane was cancelled. It was a Garuda flight. And there wasn't COVID at that time, it was bird flu. Garuda's a bird. The plane must have got bird flu. And the monk, I said, Venerable Panyawala, he laughed his head off. He said, can I use that? I said, of course. Make people happy. You give the talk tonight. And the message from Ajahn Brahm is, I'm okay, but the plane has got bird flu. Now, when you have a different attitude to difficulties in life, it still all works out okay. It's not the end of the world. Unfortunately, the world doesn't end that easily. So, little by little, that positive attitude to life means that we can be free of worries about the past, which is great. So when you're free of worries about the past, it means you can have all this energy for enjoying this moment in the present moment and having fun in it and not worrying so much. Worrying and fear. Obviously, we've got to be cautious, and there are problems in the world, we've got to deal with them. But we don't deal with problems by worrying about them. Little by little, we can solve things. Now, I always say one of the big things with climate control, and this is a very dangerous thing. And I always say the main reason, I think, one of the causes, which hardly anybody mentions, which is creates environmental damage to the planet, is having too many people, too many kids. We need more monks and more nuns. And we're going to have monks and nuns. That's going to be my suggestion for any climate conferences. Subsidize monasteries, not the coal industry. Wouldn't that be a good thing? They would have less kids. Anyway, let's back to being serious. Meditation. So once you have some energy and some mindfulness, then what happens is that you sit down. Not every meditation will be a good one. It can't be. This is one of those stories. Look, many of you have heard this before, but... I've only been around 70 years, and I give so many talks and so many retreats. You're going to hear these things again and again and again, but I try and change them a tiny bit. This is about the migrant. And sometimes in Australia, the migrants aren't treated well. But I always remember that lovely story of this Vietnamese migrant who came here to West Australia, on a boat, when they're fleeing Vietnam for their lives. And he came, a really young man, and I don't know if he had a shirt on his back. Everything got robbed on the way, and he was just so happy, relieved, to see land. And it was West Australia. And the first Australians he met were these two Aussie fishermen. And the two Aussie fishermen, they looked at this guy, they realized where he'd come from. And they shouted out to him, "Welcome, mate! Have a beer!" Now, I don't recommend serving beer to people, but nevertheless, it was like a gesture of kindness and warmth when they were first met. You don't get that if you arrive at the airport. But arriving there, he was welcome. And he said that changed his whole feeling of where he'd landed. The first thing he got was kindness. And I mention him because you may know him, that he became the governor of South Australia. He only recently sort of retired. Two terms. Brilliant. I love those sorts of stories. Give someone a tiny bit of kindness and they pay it back hundredfold, thousandfold afterwards. Well, this migrant story, a guy who came over to Australia, and in his country he was just really highly educated, but you know, some of those certificates aren't recognised here. It's just, you know, sometimes that you go to some of these countries and if you're a teacher of meditation, you know, you have to, you can't just go and teach, you have to be qualified. So I said, well, no, I've done none of those courses. I don't think I can teach meditation in some of those centres in the United States. I wrote the book, but I didn't do the course, the study. So anyway, so this poor guy, he had to get a work at a building site. Even though he was some high-flying doctor or research chemist or something before. And it's hard work at a building site, but he worked very hard. And after he finished work on Monday, he went home and his wife asked, how much did he get? He said, got nothing, no pay at all. I said, that's a bit mean. He worked very hard, so he went there on Tuesday and Wednesday, same thing happens, no pay packet. And his wife, you know, was just really upset. He was upset. Now, Australians, you know, we exploit migrants. That's what they thought. He went to work on Thursday as well, still getting nothing. And when he went to work on Friday, he didn't work hard at all, only maybe half a day. And the boss came up to him and gave him this big wad of cash, his pay packet. And when he went home, he was so happy. And he told his wife, he said, I finally figured out how it works in Australia. From today on, I'm only going to work on Fridays, on pay days. And of course, I tell that joke simply because that sometimes meditators think like that. You want every day, every meditation to be payday. But you know you are, as it were, paid. And for all the other meditations you did, where the mind was not so deep, was not so enjoyable, but you carried on meditating there, learning, figuring out what's happening inside of your mind. So little by little, that mindfulness and that commitment to the path, not through force, but I'm going to keep doing this no matter what. And then you find out that you do have breakthroughs, you have paydays. If you haven't had a payday yet on this retreat, don't worry. The check is in the mail. I understand the mind, I understand how this works, it has to happen. It's not up to you, it's not because, you know, you're somehow different than other people. We always like to think we're different, we're not. We all have these deep abilities, and personally I can't know, I can't judge. Now, who's a great meditator, who's not a great meditator? Remind me of that other story. There was one time I was just hanging around on a Friday afternoon by the offices there where people were registering, you know, on the first day of the retreat. And while I was sitting around there helping to register some people, you know, because even though I'm a senior monk, you still like helping out wherever you can. And this guy came up, Caucasian, really quite tall, and bushy hair, and it was the January retreat, because it was summertime, because he had all these tattoos on him, lots of bare skin, traditional Aussie cultural uniform, no thongs and t-shirt, and he said that he'd registered. Actually, before he said he'd even registered for the retreat, I summed him up straight away. Now, well, you see a guy like that coming on the retreat, and tattoos all over him. And I said, I think you got the wrong place. The prison farm is 6 kilometres up the road. Really stupid I am sometimes. And he said, no, I'm on the retreat. So what's your name? And he was down there. I'd never seen him before. But anyway, he was registered for the retreat, fair enough. And so he got a nice place to stay. And I mentioned this story because, you know, I didn't think he even should be on the retreat, by the way he looked. But he taught me a lesson, because when he came for one of the interviews, I was just blown away. He started saying about, you know, what had happened in his meditation, sitting down and getting very peaceful, very joyful, watching the breath. The breath was just really nice, and did that for such a long time, and then his beautiful lights came up in his mind, the nimittas. He stayed with them and just went right inside them and for a long time. That was a jhana. You've attained a jhana, mate. And the last person I'd ever thought in the retreat. And that really taught me a lesson. Just everyone has those abilities. Sometimes you just press the right button and then wham bam and off you go. So don't define yourself by your past. And those of you who've had really good meditation last time. Last time was a brilliant meditation, you got a jhana stuff. Don't imprison yourself by your successes. That's also going to cause you a lot of strife. Totally let go. Every meditation, totally new, totally fresh. But the only thing which you do learn is just how to let go, how to be free, how not to be a prisoner. And learn that whatever you're experiencing right now, this is good enough. There's even the place. Ah, okay, that old story. One of the monks, years ago, was teaching in Casuarina Jail, a new high security jail, just close to Thomas Road. And when he was... the prisoners were some really lovely people. And so they asked him afterwards, saying, can we just chat to you instead of just, you know, listening to you doing your meditation talks? Yeah, sure. So they found out what he liked to, what he could eat, cheese and chocolate and stuff like that. And so they got him some cheese and chocolate and a cup of tea, and they were chatting to him. Now, what they really wanted to know, what's it like being a monk in Australia? What do you guys do? A lot of people haven't got a clue what Buddhist monks and Buddhist nuns do. So he, you know, started telling them a life of a monk in Australia, getting up at 4 o'clock. 4 o'clock in the morning! Even murderers don't have to get up that time in this jail. What did you guys do? And all the stuff which we do, you know, in a monastery, you know, we do have breakfast in the morning most times. It actually gets worse and worse and worse. Or worse and worse, or better and better. Ananda, what do you reckon? Better. And we have a lunch, but we have nothing in the evening. So, wow, don't they feed you in the evening? You should come in this prison in the evening. You can just get whatever food you like, as much as you want. You can have vegan, vegetarian, meat, whatever, fish. As much. Not as a monk. Oh, you poor. And what do you do in the evening? Can you watch the TV? We don't have TVs in monasteries. We meditate. And anyway, I told him, and what about, what time do you go to sleep? What time do you go to bed? Bed? We don't have beds in monastery. We sleep on the floor. At least I do, anyway. And they were actually quite surprised how austere life is as a monk in Australia. And you know the punchline is coming, here it comes, when they said, that's terrible living in your monastery. Why didn't you come in here and stay with us instead? In Casuarina High Security Jail. And they didn't realise what they were saying, but there was a lot of truth to that. In an Australian jail, it's much more comfortable than in Dhammasala Monastery. Or in Bodhidharma Monastery. Well, what's the difference? It's because in a monastery, people want to be there. Here in this retreat, you want to be here. That's the big difference. And that just opened up any place you don't want to be. any place you don't want to be is called jail. That might be just waiting for this talk to finish. And then this is jail for you. Or just waiting for the retreat to be over, waiting for the bus to come, waiting for anything. You don't want to be here, you want to be somewhere else. You just put yourself in prison. So how do you escape prison? So simple. Just want to be here. Look at the beautiful stuff here. And then you're not in prison anymore. You're free. Freedom from desire, not freedom of desire. I'll come back to that later. But anyway, so when you are feel to be free, when you're not fighting, you're not wasting the energies of your mind, it's so easy to be mindful when you're aware of something you like. You're watching the floor. It's a beautiful bamboo floor. Are you getting bored? Boredom will only occur if you don't like what you're doing. Do you ever get bored having lunch? Mm-hmm. You enjoy it. Why not meditation? Closing your eyes, just feeling your body. I do this so often, I'm never bored just watching my own body, because I know how to relax. It gets really peaceful. And even when it's sick, it's sick, and I know just now how it is to watch part of the body which is sick, which is in pain. And just pain is just what the body does to respond to some illnesses. It's natural, so I just let it be. Give it some kindness. And it may sort of hurt, but it hurts far less when you're not trying to get rid of it. Even when you are depressed. I said this to a guy a couple of years ago. And he wanted special counselling because he was really depressed. And I talked to him and said, look, you're depressed. Yeah. So what did you have for breakfast this morning? He wondered what I was getting at. He said, well, actually, because I was depressed, I could have whatever I wanted, so I had a big plate of ice cream, actually two bowls of ice cream, for breakfast. Did you enjoy that? I said, yeah, it was delicious. You see, these are advantages when you're depressed. So remember those advantages. Did you have to go to work this morning? He said, no, because I'm depressed. Great, he said. Honestly, this is true. I could start to see, we started to smile. I said, see, now that's how to overcome depression. See all the benefits from it and milk it to the max. But remember that when you get out of your depression, don't tell your wife. Otherwise you lose your ice cream bonuses and you'll have to go back to work. And straight away that's a different way of looking at the joy and the happiness, seeing benefits in things rather than the terrible things in it. That just got him out of his depression. But he didn't tell anybody for a few days, so I found out. So little things like that, and the joy and the happiness, and just being with what you have. It's amazing what you can do. Even like when you're meditating, posture. You know what the most important part of your body posture is? If you want to have really nice deep meditation, it doesn't matter what your legs are up to. They can be all sorts of places. It doesn't matter where you put your hands, this way or that way or whatever. Doesn't matter if you've got a straight back or it's all crooked over here like that. The most important part of your posture, and I say this with seriousness, believe it or not, is this. You put a smile on your face when you're meditating and you'll find the mind will engage more with whatever meditation object you're focusing on. I often do that, teach it. You get into some meditation, you're reasonably peaceful, but it's not really taking off. Take your awareness away from whatever you're watching, put it on your mouth, turn the corners up, and it encourages the mind to start seeing some happiness inside. And sometimes that's just lighting a match on the kindling, and the flame sort of takes off and you've got a nice fire of happiness inside. Little things like that. I know people always worry about postures. Is there some magic posture you get deep meditation? Do you have to sit like this or have to sit like that? The one experience which I like telling people was, again, surprised me, was when I had scrub typhus in the monk's ward of Ubon Hospital in northeast Thailand in 1975. Would have been 75, 76, around then. Very tough hospital, third world part of Thailand. And there was, nothing was working because no one knew I had scrub typhus, because there wasn't any scrub typhus in the region. Not for locals. We sort of Westerners got it. So I was just so weak. I never felt so exhausted in my life. It must have been 24, 25, that's all. Just actually to go to the toilet. No one would help you, because there's a one male nurse there for about a dozen sort of beds and the ward six on either side. And so you just had to just to get up and just fall onto the next bed, clamber over the bed and then go to the next bed to actually get to the end of the ward where the toilet was. And then when you did get to the toilet, you made sure you spent your time there to get everything out. You didn't want to do that too many times a day. Exhausted. Didn't have any toilet bowls for the bed. So anyway, that one day, that story when Ajahn Chah came to see me, and that was wow. I was only a junior monk, and the big boss, Ajahn Chah, came. Wow, Ajahn Chah's come to see me. Yay! And then he came up to me. He didn't stay very long, maybe about 30 seconds. But I got 30 seconds anyway. And he gave me, I still to this day don't know whether it was as good or bad, because all he actually said was, "Now, Brahma Wang, so you'll either get better or you'll die." And then he left. You can't argue with that, can you? You can't say that's wrong. That's so true. I'd rather get better off. I didn't like it, I must admit. I thought, I'll kind of do something better than that. But anyway, so at this one time, you feel, no energy. No, Ajahn Chah had been to see you. And so physically, you're just at the lowest. So what did I do? Meditated. And that was weird. Because I don't know why I did that. Because it's totally hopeless. How can you meditate? You can't even sit up. And your body is so just weak. But anyway, decided to meditate. And just watch my body. Relax as much as I could. Watch my mind. Watch my breath. Wow. That's when you got this really great meditation. Your whole body vanished. And your mind was just so bright and brilliant and joyful. Amazing stuff. And of course, you don't want to interfere with anything. Just enjoy that as much as you can. Don't know how long I was meditating like that. But anyway, when I came out, you know, the first thing I noticed, my posture. I just had one of the really nice deep meditations. How's my posture? So leg this way, another leg that way, an arm this way, an arm over there. I've never ever seen a posture like that in any book about meditation. But nevertheless, it was a fantastic, very deep meditation. It's almost like it was teaching me something to share with other people. As long as your body is comfortable, what does your body want to do? How is your body regarding your posture? What is it like? And after a while you find out bodily posture is not that important as long as you're comfortable, as long as you're at ease. So that's one of the reasons why first thing which I do when I sit down to meditate, just check my body. I don't tell the body what to do. I ask my legs, how are you, legs? Old legs, I know you very well. And I'm willing to adjust. Adjust in positions I've even never been in before. That's what my body wants, my body gets it. How's my butt? These days my butt takes increased pressure. I've got to make sure my butt is comfortable. Now, years ago, when I started meditating, I found out that my legs would go to sleep almost every time. And then what happened was that I decided to, oh, what the heck, I could let them go to sleep. You know, I don't think I'm going to be lame afterwards. I just sat there, not moving. I remember what happened next was the feelings came back by themselves. I didn't do anything. You know, your body has got some wonderful ways of dealing with problems which you don't have to get involved in. It's just automatic. I remember, so when you did have sloth and torpor and your body was slumped, every time I tried to straighten my back, it would slump again. But then I decided, oh, what the heck, I'm just going to slump. And then, of course, you probably had this experience as well, you're slumping. And then the body straightens up all by itself. I never did that. I never gave that order. It's an automatic process. And I trust my body so much. I know when it wants to do something, it does it. Even sometimes on the subject of posture, sometimes that when you are meditating, you start twisting around. Or, you know, sometimes you'll even like moving around. But I remember the time when somebody, so at the end of the meditation, they said, oh, Ajahn Brahm, have a look at that woman over there. And I didn't, and she was really twisted. And I'm not going to try and show you how twisted she was, otherwise you'll have to send me to the hospital. It was impossibly twisted. And in her posture. So I waited for her to come out and took her aside and I said, how do you feel? She said, I feel fantastic, I feel wonderful. I said, this is weird. Because the reason I'm asking you is, while you're meditating, do you realize she was twisted all around? And she said, no. And then I realized it was a stupid one, it was me. Oh yeah. When did you have your car accident? You have got psychic powers, Ajahn Brahm. I never told you that. It's not psychic powers, it's just science of the body and meditation. I told her that that was the reason why you'd been twisted around during the meditation. You didn't know about it. You had a very peaceful meditation, and while you were just watching your breathing or watching the peace inside of you, your body took the opportunity to twist around. So the energy which needed to go to heal parts of your body which had been damaged could actually get there. You probably, that part of the body has had a huge healing. I said, yeah, it feels really good. And it's experiences like that which show me, please, your job is not to control your body or be scared of it. If your body starts to adjust the posture itself, please let it. And the other part of this is like the hot spots in the body. But sometimes you're meditating and you're getting very peaceful. And then a part of your body, only one part of the body gets really hot. Like a sort of a feverish, but just in one part of the body. And that's also some healing going on. Very often that people used to have these whiplash injuries from car accidents. And get the whole back gets really warm. Nicely warm, but unusually warm. And afterwards, it feels so relaxed. Again, body's energies have healed something. Or in parts of your body, where there might be some cancer coming up, it feels warm and hot. Please don't get excited, don't get scared. It's just healing going on. And that's one part of meditation which I often say I wish more people would investigate that, give it some scientific background. because it works. I've seen it happen too many times to actually deny its efficacy. And now you feel that for yourself, which is wonderful. You're sitting here, you're supposed to have some sort of sickness, you meditate, things get peaceful. You can feel just healing happening. When it does, great, don't change the posture, don't do anything. Just enjoy. And little by little, once the body gets comfortable, and you know how to make it comfortable, listen to it. You listen to it and acknowledge and just do what the body suggests. It's amazing just how the body can be really, really peaceful, very healthy, and it allows you to meditate really deeply. Of course, what happens next, then you can start watching the breath. It's easy. And you're enjoying it. Just the breath going in, breath going out. You enjoy doing walking meditation. It's lovely to do. The wonderful thing about walking meditation, I never mentioned yesterday, is you start at one end of the path, you go to the other end, you turn around, you come back again. In walking meditation, you always end up where you started, which I thought was very profound. In meditation, people get things. They achieve things. In walking meditation, you start in one place, you turn around, you come back again. It's great. Well, if it's walking in a hall there, but also be careful, because people always want to do things and prove themselves. So don't try and be, if there's two or three people in one of those halls, so don't try and assess your speed compared to the others in that hall. I remember being stupid and doing that years and years and years ago. I'm a monk, so I should go slower than everybody else. So we're having this competition, who can go the slowest? It's crazy, isn't it? Even sometimes years and years ago, never in this place, but now after the talk, carry on meditating. And I made a resolution on one of these retreats I did. My resolution was, I'm going to be the last out of the hall. I'm a monk. I've got to stand up for monks. So I actually sit down for them, not stand up for them. But anyway, I'd be the last. You know what happens? Because it's all ego. Half an hour after the talk finished, I'd open one eye. Who does she think she is? What's he up to? Carry on meditating there. And so I close my eyes and wait for another 10 minutes. Still there. Damn him. See how stupid it can be. Open eye. Yes, she's gone, she's gone. It's only him now. Come on. So we don't compare ourselves. We're totally letting go. Being peaceful. And this is actually how we can have some wonderful meditation here. And when it does start to happen, we don't ever look at it as a personal achievement. We don't look at things as personal failures. We don't look at it anyway like that. We've got nothing to compare it to. We let go of the past. And our present moment is all we really have. Enjoying this moment. You have so many more days left of this retreat. Enjoy. Don't rush. Where you're trying to get to anyway. Don't try and get anywhere. Just be here. And enjoy this moment. Nothing to do. Nothing to achieve. Nothing to add to what you've already got. Nothing to get rid of. Just enjoy being here. It's one of the few places you can be in the world where you're not going to be assessed. I will not assess you. Leha won't assess you. The nuns won't assess you. Venerable Ananda won't assess you. The teddy bears might assess you. Nothing won't. So just don't assess yourself. Be kind. Open the door of your heart to this moment. Whatever it is. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. I forget. No, that's in the past. I've let go of forgetting.
Freedom of desire.
Oh, yeah, but that's another talk. It's not this talk. So please don't assess me. Okay, just very quickly. Freedom, two freedoms. Freedom of desire, freedom from desire. Which would you like?
Both.
Both. Fair enough. Freedom of desires means you get whatever you want whenever you want it. Freedom from desire, you don't want anything in the whole world. What you've got now is good enough. And that, honestly, that's just such an amazing insight to realize that's what the Buddha taught. No, you can get whatever you want whenever you want it. You just don't want anything. Imagine. You don't need anything else in the whole world. You don't want anything else. You're retired, you're safe, healthy, whatever it is. Something which is not going to change. You don't need anything. Totally free of desire. That's bliss. If you want something, it's called stress. The difference between where you are and where you want to be. Stress. When you're happy to be here, really happy to be here, and appreciate every part of this moment. When you close your eyes, you start blissing out. And those deep meditations, they can't be resisted. You don't want them. It's just what happens when you don't want them. Anyway, you're almost starting me off on another 1 hour talk. Now let's go and do some interviews now. Very good. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Okay.